Welcome to Scientific American's Science Talk, posted on January 30th, 2020. I'm Steve Mirsky. On this episode...
You know, it's both scary but exciting that we're kind of in the most consequential few decades in the past few hundred million years.
That's Peter Brannan. On his website, he describes himself as a placental mammal, but he's also an award-winning journalist and the author of the book The Ends of the World, Volcanic Apocalypses, Lethal Oceans, and Our Quest to Understand Earth's Past Mass Extinctions, a book that the journal Science called a surprisingly lyrical investigation of Earth's mass extinctions. He was in New York City recently, and we sat down together to talk about the book. Midway through our discussion, we'll take a break for a short segment sponsored by the Kavli Prize with Stanford neuroscientist Carla Schatz, which, perhaps surprisingly, has some connections with the discussion of mass extinctions. And now, Peter Brannan. Let's talk about mass extinction.
All right.
The book is really kind of a survey of the great mass extinctions in the history of our planet.
Yeah.
There's a reason, though, that you go through all that, and that's related to what's happening today.
Right. Yeah. I really wrote it because I think in the popular imagination, mass extinctions are what happens when big rocks from space hit the planet. And I'd noticed that there was this really interesting conversation going on in the geology community over the last 30 years or so where – yes, an asteroid seems to have something to do with why the dinosaurs went extinct, but there are all these older mass extinctions, some of which were much more severe, and almost all of them had to do with severe, rapid climate change driven by changes in carbon dioxide, basically, in the atmosphere. And so I thought there was both this sort of sci-fi story about these sort of lost worlds that you might not be familiar with because everyone's familiar with the dinosaurs, but the planet really has been a bunch of different planets over its lifetime. And so I thought that was really interesting to write about. But there's also this news hook about, hey, we're starting to pull some of the same levers that have been pulled in the worst things that have ever happened.
This time we're pulling the levers. In the past, natural processes have pulled the levers.
Right, yeah. So in the past when this has happened, it's been, for the most part, sort of tectonic cataclysms. So in one of the mass extinctions, there's some weird stuff going on with mountain building that might draw down CO2 and plunge you into an ice age. But for a bunch of the mass extinctions actually seem to be associated with these huge apocalyptic volcanic events called large igneous provinces, where just an unimaginable amount of lava comes out of the earth, covering thousands of in one case, 3 million square miles. But lava alone, if it comes out in one part of the world, can't kill everything on the planet. It has to be, you know, because things on the other side of the planet seem to be going extinct in these mass extinctions. So scientists are trying to figure out what, you know, it must have something to do with the gases that are coming out at the same time. And what you see in some of the mass extinctions is, but if you know how to read the rocks, if you're a really clever geochemist, you can see that there are these huge injections of carbon dioxide into the air from these volcanoes. And you can tell that it gets really warm and the ocean starts to lose its oxygen and this thing called ocean acidification, which we're doing now, which is what happens when too much CO2 reacts with seawater, is happening in these mass extinctions too. So it's sort of unnerving to see that, you know, we're not there yet, but we're trending in a direction where if you go too far down that road, it can really be all hell breaks loose.
Right. A lot of people have said we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, but the scientists you talk to are a little more conservative than that.
Well, I think paleontologists are. Certainly, you know, if you're a conservation biologist or you're an ecologist, you can, you know, you just see this sort of tragedy unfolding all around you. And I'm not trying to minimize the catastrophic damage humans have done to the planet. But I think it's actually – it's both worrying that we could even be in the same conversation as these mass extinctions because these are just – you're turning everything up to 11 and trying as hard as you can to kill everything on the planet. I mean, this is the – the boundary sort of condition for how hard the planet can be pushed. And we're not there yet, which is the good news. We still have time to save the planet. And that's really the point of that sort of discussion in the book that, you know, we're driving species extinct at a crazy rate today, but there's still time before, you know, we get to the level of, you know, when the asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs or when these giant volcanoes were happening. So there's time to save the turn the ship around, and it's sort of, you know, it's both scary but exciting that we're kind of in the most consequential few decades in the past few hundred million years. It's really up to us to avert to avert this.
It's kind of mind-boggling. And I didn't mean to minimize what's going on right now by saying that the scientists you spoke to are a little more conservative about whether we're in the sixth mass extinction. It's more like you don't have lung cancer yet. You only have emphysema.
Right.
So everything's cool.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Everything's bad.
Right. Exactly. If we keep up the current rates, then we'll get there for certain in the next few decades to centuries to millennia, depending on how you count. But we will get there for certain if we don't change our behavior. And we're making this sound like a very depressing book, but there's some lighter moments to it, I'd say.
I didn't find any lighter moments. I thought it was completely depressing.
Oh, no.
No, there are lighter moments, and some of that has to do with your felicity as a writer rather than anything that's actually happening out there.
And scientists are funny people, too.
And scientists are funny people. For example, since we're trying to have a good time here, let's talk about the first time you went out with the Cincinnati Rockhound people, and the guy, he had a name for something that you picked up.
Yeah, right. So if you know how to read the rocks and you know what you're looking at, there is, no matter where you are in the country, there's not a boring spot for geology. And there's some great – there's an app called Rockt, which you can download on your phone, and it will tell you what you're standing on basically. And so no matter where you are, if you're in New England, you can look up, oh my goodness, I'm on this volcanic archipelago that crashed into, tropical North America 450 million years ago. Or if you're in Boulder, where I am, there's red rocks from the middle of Pangaea and the Age of Dinosaurs. And, there really isn't a boring – or right here in New York, we're on top of either Cambrian stuff, so from the dawn of animal life, ocean rock, or in Brooklyn, there's glacial stuff from these crazy ice ages that happened not that long ago. And there's some Cretaceous stuff in Staten Island from the Age of Dinosaurs, from these big river deltas. So there's an amazing story underneath your feet no matter where you are. And geology is just this sort of amazing, endlessly fascinating field that sort of tells you about these alien worlds that the planet's been before. So I sort of crisscrossed the country and joined up with professional geologists, and then was sort of introduced to these groups of amateur geologists who are really inspiring people because they take their own time out of their own weekends to just pull over to the side of the road in these unloved highway road cuts because they know that there's amazing fossils there and they're incredibly dedicated to it. And I was sort of a newbie, and I joined up with them one day to look for fossils on the side of the highway in Cincinnati, because it turns out that in Cincinnati, 450 million years ago, it was a shallow sea. And it was filled with sort of weird things that look like horseshoe crabs and these giant squid-like things. And so it's just this totally alien sci-fi world.
In fact, Cincinnati lends its name to a particular period of time because of that.
Right. There's this thing called the Cincinnatian in the late Ordovician period, because Cincinnati is the best place in the world to find fossils from this period, right before this big mass extinction. But I went there and I went with all these sort of really interesting, quirky people who do this in their spare time, just pull over to the side of the road looking for fossils. And we were finding lots of these things called graptolites, which are these weird sea creatures that swam in these colonial homes and stuff like that. Not colonial homes, like I'm from New England, so not
right,
that sort
right,
of
thing. Not like that.
So I was finding a lot of those. And so I would ask people, what's this? And say, oh, it's a trilobite. Oh, it's a graptolite. And then I thought I found something, and I showed it to this guy, and I asked what it was. And he said, that's a leverite. And I said, is that good? And he said, yeah, lever right there. And he took it out of my hand and he threw it on the ground.
Yeah, that was pretty good.
Yeah.
So you went out with a whole bunch of different people, or amateurs and professional researchers, and saw a lot of – I just got back from England, and I saw the White Cliffs of Dover.
Right.
So the White Cliffs of Dover are like a really good example of a lot of the stuff you're talking about. It's all fossils.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think people don't appreciate that limestone for the most part is stuff that was – it's calcium carbonate that was sort of precipitated by sea creatures. And, if you go to Indiana and you see limestone, if you put it under a microscope, you can see it's just all – a lot of it's like little sea creatures and things like that. And the White Cliffs of Dover are coccolithophores, which are this – you see today from space in these giant swirling blue-green sort of hurricanes in the ocean. And it's just plankton. And you give plankton enough time and it can build up – something like the White Cliffs of Dover, this giant edifice of living, once living stuff.
And this is something that I think, even with the the very good kind of examples that you give, the analogies, like you're walking through time and each step is, what, 100 years? I forget.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how long would it take to get back to pre-industrial civilization? Well, pretty quick.
Yeah.
How long would it take to get back to the dinosaurs? It's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
But even though that makes it sound like you can understand it.
Right.
I don't think you can ever really – the human brain, I don't think – I was in the Grand Canyon a couple of years ago down on the river,
right,
rafting through the canyon. And it occurred to me as I was down there that I didn't know if something was a mile away or 10 miles away.
Right.
I didn't know if something was 500 feet high or 3,000 feet high. I couldn't – the scale was just blowing me away and I didn't feel confident in my – ability to estimate any kind of distances,
right,
let alone, you know, what's 100 million years to,
yeah,
to an organism that has a lifespan in decades.
Right.
I don't think we can get it.
No.
And it's a part, yeah, of the problem with getting the point across at what kind of a dire situation this is.
Yeah. No, I think it's some, it's kind of like quantum mechanics where it's just we evolved as primates in Africa not to understand these scales because our human lifetimes are so short. So it really is as hard to picture as that, where if you go for a walk and every footstep's a century, yeah, you would get to prehistory before we leave this office. But to get to the age of to get to the beginning of the age of dinosaurs, you'd have to walk to the middle of Nebraska. So yeah, it's mind-blowing. And it does put in perspective how just sort of out of control we are as a species that – these things only happen if you're walking across the country and every footstep you take is a century. These things happen every few hundred miles or so. And in the next century, we could reproduce the effects of some of these events that are just incredibly rare catastrophes in Earth history.
Let's go through the mass extinctions.
All right.
Just as a lark.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I've gotten better at sort of running through these, it's hard to talk about 600 million years in a few minutes. But so the first one, you know, the Cambrian, which I think people are familiar with, when sort of animal life explodes into the fossil record, Cambrian starts 543 million years ago. And then the first mass extinction isn't until 445 million years ago. This is the end Ordovician mass extinction. And this really is a sci-fi planet. Pangaea is still hundreds of millions of years in the future. Dinosaurs are hundreds of millions of years in the future. There's no life on land at all. It would have looked like, you know, what the Mars Curiosity rover feed, basically, if you went onto the continents. But there's tons of life, and it's all in the ocean. Fish exist, but they're basically completely ecologically insignificant. This is a bug world. It's things with shells and creepy crawlies and squid-looking things and giant shells and things that look like horseshoe crabs and trilobites and all this stuff. And life is thriving like it sort of never has before. The Cambrian explosion gets a lot of credit, but the Cambrian was sort of an unpleasant time for life on Earth. There was pulses of anoxic oceans, and it might have been really warm. But the Ordovician, it's cooling off, and the diversity of life on Earth triples in only 10 million years or something like that, and reefs start becoming an ecological thing. And then right at the end, everything dies. 88% or something of life on Earth dies, and it's the – by some accounts, the second worst mass extinction of all time. And it's very obvious that there is a massive ice age because the same sorts of things you see in, you know, New England from and New York City from the last ice age, you know, these glacial till and all these things, you can find in the middle of Africa, in the middle of Sahara Desert, which was over the South Pole at the time. The continents were flooded with shallow seas, and a lot of the sea life lived up there. And so you suddenly put a giant ice cap on South Pole, sea level drops hundreds of feet. You're destroying all this habitat that was in these shallow seas on the continents in places like Cincinnati. And then you're also changing the circulation of the ocean. So you're changing where food is for things that live in sort of more open ocean. And everything basically dies. Not everything, obviously, or we wouldn't be here. But we'll jump to 375 million years ago.
Life has rebounded.
Yeah. Fish radiate after the Ordovician mass extinction. And the Ordovician was known as the sea without fish, which is sort of – it's an overstatement, but it sort of captures what that weird alien world was like. By the Devonian, the second mass extinction, we're now in the age of fishes. And these are really weird fish. A lot of them had these giant armor-plated heads and these the scariest one, this thing called Dunkelosteus, which you find in Cleveland, of all places, eroding out of the riverbanks, had this like guillotine-like mouth and one of the strongest bite forces in Earth history. And they were the size of buses. They were huge.
It's crazy.
Yeah. But so the Devonian's a really interesting one and kind of an oddball, because not only is there – there's a bunch of extinctions at the end of the Devonian, and the seas seem to keep losing their oxygen. But it's also an amazing period in Earth history because plant life is taking off on land. The first forests show up in – outside of Albany. the first fish start waddling onto land, things like Tiktaalik, which, you know, Neil Shubin has written about. And so it's this really important transitional moment, but there's these pulses of extinction. And one of them, the biggest one, wipes out 99.99% of the biggest reef systems of all time. It wipes out these weird armor-plated fishes, which limp through and then get wiped out at the end of the extinction. And it might actually be from the trees. Some of these mass extinctions might have been caused by the trees because, you know, we think today of trees as these wonderful things, which they are. But when they first took over the whole continents, that was really a massive geoengineering project on a global scale. And it took a while for the planet to sort of global chemical cycles to figure themselves out.
Spewing out this toxic oxygen.
Well, that they did that. But things liked oxygen by this point. It more was that they were there's a massive ice age at the end of the Devonian, which might be from trees drawing down CO2. But they're also breaking down rocks and releasing all these nutrients that were in the continents and polluting, I guess, quote unquote, the seas with phosphorus, which we spread on our crops today. And we're similarly driving dead zones with it. That might have been causing these low oxygen dead zones. So that's a weird one. The first two are actually kind of weird. And the last three are sort of have some thematic similarities.
We'll return to Peter Brannon after this short break from the Kavli Prize.
How our brains allow us to perceive the world around us, and how that information then reshapes our brains, has always been a mystery. Carla Schatz, a pioneer who helped determine the principles of early brain development, made the unexpected discovery that the brain actually starts rehearsing for vision before we even open our eyes. That achievement earned her the 2016 Kavli Prize in Neuroscience. As part of our partnership with the Kavli Prize, Scientific American Custom Media spoke with Schatz about some of the biggest questions in neuroscience and how answering them could help us become better people. But first, Schatz described what we know about how our brains get ready to see the sights.
The eye is sending test patterns to the brain, and those test patterns are being used to tune up brain circuits for vision even before birth. And this was extremely unexpected. Now we know that this kind of testing of circuits happens not only in the visual system, but also throughout the brain during very early development.
Since then, Schatz and her colleagues have identified molecules that help prime babies' brains for learning new things, and molecules that make it harder to learn as adults.
What we discovered is that one of those molecules that applies the brakes to learning is a molecule that regulates the ability of the brain to remove synaptic connections. So those synapses are the connections between one nerve cell and another, and they're absolutely critical for learning and memory. And in fact, your memories are stored at synapses, and when you learn something new, then those connections between nerve cells actually strengthen.
And when she removed these molecular breaks in adult mice?
We were surprised to find that they were smarter than wild-type mice.
But scientists wonder, how long can this brain boost last?
We don't know how long the mice can retain this new learning. What if we stop treating the mice? Will they then revert to their normal prior level of learning? This really raises many, many other questions, including whether these molecules might even be present in our own human brains, and if so, would there be any therapeutic value to manipulating the molecules in the human brain?
Could this work help to rejuvenate aging brains, or even reverse the effects of neurodegenerative disease?
In Alzheimer's disease, it's very clear that the memory loss is due, especially early on in the disease, to the pruning or loss of those synaptic connections. So it gets to be a pretty grim situation if you're losing connections where your memories are stored. In a way, you're sort of losing your own personality and self. to me, it would be incredibly exciting if someday we had a method not only for preventing Alzheimer's disease, but also for treating memory loss in a way that would allow people, if not to reconnect with their lost memories, then at least to be able to restore by new training some semblance of normal function to the brain by, you know, adding back new synaptic connections.
Of course, that leads to the age-old question.
How do you bridge the gap between molecules and cells and circuits on the one hand, and great questions like how we think and feel, and even the unanswered question of consciousness? And I think this is a huge challenge for the future and a very exciting area, I think, of research, because there is this gap. We've been so reductionist in our approach to understanding the biology of the brain, but the brain does not compute by using neurons one at a time. What's exciting now, I think, is that other areas of science and technology are being brought to bear on this problem of bridging the gap, monitoring hundreds of thousands of neurons computing to create a behavior. Years ago, I think you could have said, oh, it's really hard, you can't do it, nobody's interested. I think now the question is really, how do you keep your door closed so they don't all come rushing in, trampling everyone?
Our future may depend on the work of these curious explorers of the mind.
One question that really needs to be answered in order for our planet to survive is the question of how people make decisions. And also, I think, the question of where altruism comes from and whether this is something that's fundamental to human nature or, as I believe, is something that is taught and learned very early on in childhood development. I think if we're really going to survive on this planet and treat each other with dignity, these are questions that absolutely must be answered, and very, very soon.
This podcast was made possible through the support of the Kavli Prize. The Kavli Prize recognizes scientists for pioneering advances in the fields of astrophysics, nanoscience, and neuroscience. The Kavli Prize is a partnership between the Norwegian Academy of Science and Letters, the Norwegian Ministry of Education and Research, and the U.S.-based Kavli Foundation. Carla Schatz is a professor of biology and neurobiology at Stanford University and director of Stanford BioX. Don't miss the announcement for the next Kavli Prize laureates on May 27th, 2020.
And now back to Peter Brannon and the last three mass extinctions.
252 million years ago, you now have a full ecosystem of life on land, and you had plant life, you had big, ugly things walking around. Some people don't think they're ugly, but this is the age of the proto-mammals sort of are dominant, which is weird because we think about mammals having not really taken off until after the dinosaurs got wiped out, which is true because these things weren't really mammals yet, but they were on our side of the family tree and they were the dominant part of the terrestrial ecosystem. Things like gorgonopsids, which are just these sort of vicious top predators. And reefs had bounced back in West Texas. You can, in the Guadalupe Mountains, so you can find these amazing coral reefs, the mountains that are just made out of coral reefs. And then at the end of the Permian, 252 million years ago, you get the biggest mass extinction of all time. So, something like 96% of ocean life goes extinct, a little less maybe on land. But this, for a long time, people looked for evidence of an asteroid impact. It turns out that there wasn't any that has been agreed upon and or that is convincing at all. But instead, there's this huge area of Russia where the equivalent amount of lava came out at the end of the Permian that it could have covered the lower 48 United States a kilometer deep. So that's just on a...
Yeah, that's what I mean. You can't really... You can say that and we can sit there and envision it, but we really can't grasp it, to, you know, viscerally, what that means. You know, volcanoes spewing this stuff out to bury the entire continental U.S. under...
A kilometer of gunk.
Right.
So talking about Yellowstone in the same book isn't even, it's not even, this is a once in a billion year event. And it came up through one of the world's largest coal basins. So not only do you have these horrible volcanoes, but they're spewing out unbelievable amounts of, and they're burning through carbon-rich rocks like limestone filled with natural gas. And you have these huge explosions at the surface that just inject tons of carbon into the air. And you can tell by studying the rocks in clever ways that it gets incredibly hot at the end of the Permian. in the entire tropics, it would have been the temperature of hot soup, as one paleontologist puts it. So oxygen is running out in the oceans. And I talked to someone who has this crazy sci-fi idea that the oceans were getting so hot that they were fueling these hypercanes, which are hurricanes with 500-mile-an-hour winds, which were sucking up poisonous hydrogen sulfide gas out of the ocean. And it's just the total nightmare scenario. So almost everything on the planet dies. It takes 10 million years to recover. 50 million years later, basically the same thing happens at the end of the Triassic. A giant volcano, the remains of which you can see in the Palisades across from Manhattan. The rocks in the Palisades have been dated right to the end of the Triassic. At the same time, and they're dated to the same time, the same rocks you can find in Nova Scotia, Brazil, Spain, Morocco, so all over the world. Another one of these crazy volcanic events, you wipe out all these crocodilian weirdos who are dominating the land, and you wipe out the first appearance of modern coral reefs, which show up right at the end of the Triassic. So it's basically the Permian Junior. And then you go 135 million years into the future, and then you are at the extinction of the dinosaurs, which is a story that's been told a lot, but it's getting more complicated.
Right, because you say in the book that it's not just one thing. It wasn't just the asteroid, probably. Mm-hmm. There were other bad things going on, and then that was the coup de grace.
It might have worked that way. There are still – I mean, so this is still a very divisive issue. I mean, people have lost personal and professional relationships over the extinction of the dinosaurs. I even interviewed one scientist who said he would – was happy to talk about all the extinctions except for the end Cretaceous because it was too political.
Wow.
Yeah. But the smart money is still on the asteroid. But it is very strange that at the same time the asteroid hit, there was another one of these volcanic provinces that seems to be responsible for a lot of the other mass extinctions. And it's going off in India this time. And it could cover the lower 48 United States 600 feet deep. So not quite a kilometer, but it's nothing to sneeze at. And in recent years, as people have gone back to date these lava flows, it seems like the most eruptive period of it is very close to when the asteroid hit. So either that is just a miraculous or anti-miraculous coincidence for the dinosaurs, mm-hmm. or there's some sort of connection. And people have been trying to figure out whether maybe, you know, you're disturbing Earth's mantle and causing these earthquakes that you're kicking this volcanic system into overdrive that might have been a 1-2 punch.
Mm-hmm. And also for the other mass extinctions, you know, you've got the geological processes that are belching out a lot of CO2 and the ocean acidification and the temperatures are rising. But there's other stuff that's also helping to drive life out.
Yeah. So I think because these events are so rare, it really has to be a perfect storm where these are multi cause sort of thing. So one idea in the Ordovician, which I talk about this ice age that might have killed everything, is that the continents were in strange places. There were, unlike today where you have these big north-south coastlines, where things can – we've gone in and out of ice ages in the past few 100,000 years, and there hasn't been a big mass extinction right until humans show up. And that might be because things have been able to go north and go south to track the climate that they like as the climate changes. But in the Ordovician, you sort of have these island continents where you know, things are in the ocean, but you know, a lot of things are living on shallow seas on the continents, and so when their climate changes, they can't make the gigantic journey across the ocean to get to somewhere more comfortable. They might just be stuck in a bad place.
Right, and the islands may have helped diversify life,
right,
because they're great laboratories for evolution.
Right,
but at the same time, they kept the range limited.
Yeah,
so there was no escape.
Right.
So toward the end of the book, and people, you should read the book. It's really – it's fun. It's really well written. And you talk about the unique position that humanity is in right now. And I hadn't really seen that before. It's more – usually the take is we're pretty insignificant and we're going to get wiped out eventually one way or another. Maybe we'll – spread out throughout the solar system and further over the next thousands of years. Who knows? But, you know, we're not that important. But you make a good case for that we actually may be pretty interesting and unique beings.
Yeah. No, I started to wonder when I was writing the book, how is it that we just barely made it through all these close calls where the planet almost died? And it's kind of amazing that in 4.5 billion years, we've never been set back to square one. And maybe that is a strange situation to be in, and a like uniquely lucky and sort of miraculous one that could explain why when we, you know, we haven't heard from anyone else yet when we turn our telescopes towards the skies, because, you know, most planets just do get wiped out by one of these things. And so we might have been gifted this incredible head start where we have this sort of perfect world. And this is why when I hear about these ideas to terraform Mars, I sort of roll my eyes, because, you know, we are basically on the perfect planet already, and 4 to 6 degrees of climate change could be a catastrophe here, and we're going to go somewhere millions of miles away and make it 75 degrees warmer, and it's going to be wonderful. Like, let's make the perfect planet like livable first. It would be such a tragedy to squander sort of the gift of the biosphere and the planet as it exists today, because most planets might not be as lucky as we are.
And you also mentioned, you know, people talk about the possible temperature rises, but the human body itself has an upper limit. And that's way before we reach that, way before we reach what the potential global temperature rises are going to be.
Well, yeah. So there's this thing called the wet bulb temperature, which is basically a measure of how hot and humid it can get before you just can't do anything to cool off. And what's funny in the papers about this is they talk about, so above this thing called like 35 degrees Celsius wet bulb temperature. And the way they get this temperature is by putting a thermometer in a wet sock and spinning it around as fast as they can. And it's the idea that if we keep warming the planet, we keep putting water vapor into the air, it's going to get really humid and it's going to get really hot. And at a certain point, you start crossing these thresholds where in these papers, it says this is this simulation of this temperature is you're a human being in a dark room, naked, doused in water in gale force winds, and you're not doing anything. And even then, you can't sort of cool off. And today, this happens almost nowhere on the planet. We just don't reach this threshold. But you start warming the planet up and you start adding, you make more humid, and it goes up a few. You do actually have to get pretty warm for us to start. I mean, we're going to start seeing this by the end of the century in certain places, but to make it a global planetary threat, above like 10 degrees Celsius warming really would be humans have to abandon most of the places that they live today. You just can't, as a mammal, basically, cool yourself off in this temperature for more than a few hours before you die of heat stress.
You want to tell the story about the platoon that trained in the heat?
Yeah.
What was it, in Puerto Rico?
Yeah, it was in Puerto Rico. It was basically just this demonstration of, you know, you have the most fit people in the world who are incredibly well trained, and they started to reach these thresholds of heat stress, and this platoon on this mission in the jungle in Puerto Rico doing this training mission just completely falls apart. Doing their best to try and, you know, make it through. The leader starts getting really overheated, and then he has to get carried, and then everyone else in the platoon starts getting overheated because they have to carry the leader. And the person I was talking to, Matt Huber at UNH, was using this as an example of how, you know, this is pretty grim, but how society could fall apart. That, you know, once you start, you know, just taking out different nodes in these networks, even if everyone's pulling in the same direction, going in the same towards the same goal, that, you know, things could really fall apart pretty quickly. And these people had to basically be rescued in the jungle because, you know, heat had basically destroyed the mission.
So after all the research you did and the product that you converted that research into, when you see people on TV who talk about that this is either natural cycles that we're going through right now, and you know, the Earth's going to be fine. I mean, you know, there's the famous George Carlin.
Right.
The Earth is fine.
Yeah.
We're effed.
Yeah.
It's the Earth that's fine. But even the Earth itself may have some rough days ahead. But what's your reaction when you see people on TV who say that this is nothing? The scientists aren't the my favorite is, you know, the scientists are in the pockets of the grant
right.
funding,
right. Yeah.
which is just nuts.
Right.
But, you know, I just got a letter from a disgruntled reader the other day talking about how our climate models are, oh, they're just the margins of error in our climate models would not be tolerated in a legitimate practice like economics.
Yeah.
So what's your reaction when you see the stuff that goes on in Congress or on television with, you know, so-called pundits?
I mean, it's just so strange that that's where the conversation still is in the public sphere, given how many light years beyond it is in the scientific community. This is not – I mean, this is like if you're an astronomer and you go to physics conferences and then you see people talking about, you know, the – Earth-centric model of the solar system. It's just, you know, we figured out that CO2 is a greenhouse gas before the American Civil War. There was an op-ed in the 19-teens about how if we burn coal, it's going to, you know, cause a lot of global warming. A guy named Svante Arrhenius, a physicist, made a calculation that if we double CO2, temperature is going to go up about 4 degrees, which is, you know, he might have been a little lucky, but it's basically in line with what our supercomputers tell us today.
Yeah, he did it on an envelope, basically.
Yeah.
It was a high school chemistry teacher.
Yeah. So it's really sort of depressing that that's where the conversation is, because the science is so far beyond it. You just don't hear – there's no debate whatsoever. And even that – I think it was a Scientific American article a couple of years ago that the idea that there's just 97% consensus, that if you actually look at all the papers that have been published in journals in the last – you know, 10 years or so, it's like 99.997. It's established fact at this point.
Although, you know, my letter writer said that, you know, science has a replication problem, which is true in some fields.
Climate science does.
Right. And so, you know, we can't even really trust the science on it. Therefore, everything's fine. You know, it's kind of nuts because especially when you have to weigh your responses based on the severity of the danger that you're facing, even if it's a low probability, and it's
right.
No longer a low probability.
Right.
But all that said, what makes you hopeful? I mean, you quoted scientists in the book who said, we're effed.
Yeah. I didn't quote them, but I relayed the fact that I heard that from – if you give a scientist a few beers, you might hear that. But what makes me hopeful is – you know, this is going to sound kind of cheesy, but the younger generations, when you see polling on this for people who are going to be voting or are in the next election and in elections beyond this, it's much more encouraging. And to see even the movement in the past few years towards, you know, recognizing that we sort of have to remake our energy system, that was sort of seen as a fringy crazy idea a couple of years ago, but now even the major people, you know, candidates running for president right now are at least making feints towards in that direction. So that is encouraging, and I think it really is starting to, you know, the siren is going off for people finally. It's a shame that it didn't happen 30 years ago, but I do think that there's a new urgency to this problem that there didn't used to be. And the good news is, you know, that we're still going to cause a lot of you know, there's no way to avoid it, things getting more uncomfortable and unpleasant in the coming decades. But we still have time to really turn things around in a major way. Yeah, and I mean, if you're thinking in just planetary terms, the planet will in a million years or 10 million years, if the planet could make it through the end Permian or the end Cretaceous, the planet's going to make it through the worst we have to dish out. The problem is, you know, we can only live in the time we're given on this planet, and you know, we should be thinking about, you know, how we have to be stewards of this planet and the people that we love, and our debt to the generations that follow us. But yeah, if you're just worried about the planet's gonna be fine.
That's it for this episode. Get your science news at our website, www.scientificamerican.com, where you'll also find a couple of dozen articles about past mass extinctions, as well as coverage about the possibility of the next one. And follow us on Twitter, where you'll get a tweet whenever a new item hits the website. Our Twitter name is @SciAm. For Scientific American Science Talk, I'm Steve Mirsky. Thanks for clicking on us.